This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In 1972, when swimmer Shirley Babashoff was 15 years old, she won two silver medals in individual freestyle events and two relay golds at the Munich Olympics. Mark Spitz won seven gold medals at those games, so it was high praise indeed when people began referring to Babashoff's potential to become the female Mark Spitz. 4 years later, she was prepared to be celebrated accordingly, and that opportunity was stolen from her. 40 years later, she hasn't forgotten or forgiven. Among Babashoff's clearest memories from the run-up to the 1976 Olympics in Montreal is how thoroughly she had prepared. Before the World Championships in 1973, she began working with a new coach. She was training twice as hard as she'd ever trained.
And I felt super strong, and I was really excited about just showing people, like, how much I had improved. And that's when we noticed, when the East German women all of a sudden started beating us. None of the races were close. It was just the visual of seeing these women looking like shot putters and wrestlers. We didn't really know what was going on.
At the time, neither did anybody else. It was obvious that the East German women were swimming much faster than they'd done just a year earlier, and much faster than anybody else, despite the fact that, as Shirley Babashoff recalls, their strokes didn't look especially efficient. But they got from one end of the pool to the other more quickly than anybody else, and then they jumped out of the water as if swimming that fast had been easy.
The East Germans kept coming up and saying, oh, the reason we're so good is because we have these new swimsuits. And then they said, well, we're training at high altitude. And they always had an excuse, but that never told the truth of actually using the little blue pills, you know, which they call vitamins.
Some of them probably didn't tell the truth because they didn't know it. The East German government was systematically feeding the women steroids without telling them what they'd been given. Shirley Babashoff didn't know the details then, but she began thinking that if she was going to beat those women in 1976, she'd better alter her training in college.
I just told myself, if I'm going to be swimming against the East Germans, I need to be on the men's team.
Babashoff next encountered the East Germans at the Montreal Olympics, where she witnessed some of the unintended consequences of their doping program.
Well, the funny thing is, like, I think it was the first time that I ever really heard them talk. I'm pretty sure they were told, just don't say anything. And we were just going in to, you know, change into our swimsuits. And we went into the locker room that we thought was the women's locker room. And then we were changing and we heard these voices and they sounded just like men. And we just shrieked and said, oh my gosh, this must be like a co-ed locker room or something. We got dressed really quick and we looked around the corner and it was the East German women.
Olympic etiquette dictates that athletes take surprises like that in stride, but Shirley Babashoff couldn't pretend she hadn't seen what she'd seen.
I was getting on the bus after practice that day, and a reporter asked me, they were just swarming the bus, and someone asked me, like, what do you think of the East German swimmers? And I had mentioned that they were extremely hairy and had really deep voices. And that kind of got me in a lot of trouble.
I think you might have also mentioned that they would be fine to swim against if they didn't have mustaches or something like that.
Yeah, I probably did.
Reporters characterized Babashoff as a poor sport. U.S. Swimming sent flowers to the top East German swimmer with a note of apology. It wasn't the first time adults in charge of her welfare hadn't believed what Shirley Babashoff was saying. When she was very young, she was sexually abused night after night by her father.
It's very difficult to talk about. It's not like it was an uncle that you saw, you know, twice a year or whatever.
The abuse didn't end until one night when Babashoff realized how strong she had become.
I just fought him off. And I guess he decided it was too much work and he was just going to move on. I had a baby sister then. But, I mean, he didn't just, you know, do it to us. He was very active in the neighborhood. He, you know, last year just got a restraining order for stalking. He's 87.
All those years ago, long before she had begun to dream of swimming in the Olympics, Babashoff tried to tell her mother what was happening.
her father was a preacher, so she pretty much got the Bible out and just showed me, you know, number 5 out of the 10, the commandments, and number 5 is obey your mother and your father.
Babishoff says that in order to get through those days, she had to compartmentalize the trauma. She had to do the same with her disappointment at what happened to her at the 76 Olympics, and it couldn't have been easy.
I was 19 years old, and there was an article in Time magazine that had pictures of all these athletes, and underneath it had their name, and it said winner. And then there was a picture of me, and it said, had my name, and it said loser. And it just really bothered me that no one else would come out and say anything about it.
Babishoff did win gold in the 4x100 relay, which has been characterized as the most exciting race at the 76 Games. Her 4 other medals were silver, and it wasn't good enough for those who'd swallowed the hype. While other Olympians built careers on the medals they'd won, Babishoff moved beyond swimming and the fame and notoriety she'd known at least until the late 80s and the fall of the Berlin Wall. Much later, the files of the Stasi, the East German secret police, would become public, and the details of the doping program would be revealed. Even then, Babishoff's role as a lonely whistleblower wouldn't receive much acknowledgement.
Oh, I remember seeing a very small article in the newspaper, maybe a paragraph, and it said, oh, yeah, by the way, Shirley was right. That was pretty much it. But by this time, I mean, I had my son, and I was, you know, working at the post office, and my life was different because after Montreal, I really didn't want anything else to do with swimming.
But now, as news breaks about the recent state-sponsored doping of Russian Olympians, Babishoff has written a book titled Making Waves, and she would like to have just one more thing to do with the Olympics and with her sport. The International Olympic Committee has stripped cheaters of their medals in the past. That action has been based on positive tests that have turned up within a few years of the competition skewed by performance-enhancing drugs. The IOC has never acted to rectify the results of the systematic doping that occurred in the run-up to the 76 Games. The rationale is that too much time passed between the offenses and the appearance of the evidence necessary to change the record. But what if, at some point, that august body could see its way clear to redistributing the medals that Babishoff and others would have won if the competition had been legitimate?
Wow, that just sounds so good coming from you. I love that. Yeah, it would be amazing, and I'm glad that I'm the one that has the voice to be able to talk about this and hopefully help everyone. You know, before they die, it should be an infinity rule. If you're found out that you cheated 50 years ago, if it's the truth, it should be fixed.
Perhaps it will be. Maybe one day this little lie among so many will be addressed. And if it is, maybe some of the former Olympians opening FedEx boxes and finding medals will call Shirley Babishoff to say thanks. East Germany wasn't the last country to help its athletes to the medal stand through a state-sponsored doping program. It's the most recent of those scandals, confirmed in a damning report earlier this week that's been on the mind of commentator Mike Pesca.
A U.S. Olympian, a rower, once told me that the difference between the United States and other countries in international competition is that across the world, athletes are sent by their nations to the Olympics, but in the U.S., athletes are sent to the Olympics by citizens of the United States. And while that arrangement certainly makes it hard for U.S. rowers, divers, steeplechasers, gymnasts, and judoka, who often have to hustle and scrimp to afford equipment or training time, it does put the U.S. athletes apart from the iron claw of their federations or their countries. In the case of Russia, we have demonstrable proof that there was state-sanctioned, indeed state-enforced doping on a massive level. How massive? The track team is likely to be entirely banned from Rio, and there's a decent chance that all the Russian athletes will be barred from the 2016 Olympics. That is the recommendation of the World Doping Agency, a decision that's endorsed by many sports federations, and according to reports, the Olympic committees of the US, Spain, Germany, Canada, and at least a dozen other nations. But is it fair? Russian officials say no, but they don't really do much to serve themselves or their athletes with their reality-denying arguments. So what should be done? Well, one choice is to lower the hammer, and that is literally happening in the case of, say, Tatiana Lysenko, hammer-throwing Russian who could be stripped of her medals and banned from the sport for doping. But what about so many others who are guilty of suspicion but no more? Have you ever heard of Nikita Nagorny? He's a gymnast whose floor routine has been described as one of the most beautiful ever seen. Or the entire Russian synchronized swim team. They have won every Olympic gold medal in their sport since the Sydney 2000 Games. The evidence that they cheated? It's not tests, not testimony. It's just that they're Russian. But that's a damning association now. So this could well be a real example of collective punishment. There are some Russian athletes who've never doped. But also think of the clean athletes from other countries. On the one hand, they definitely want doping out of their sports. On the other hand, they want to compete against the best in the world. The best clean athletes in the world, but the best. So if the U.S. wins gold in synchronized swimming, the winners will hug and tear up and not get their waterproofed makeup smudged. And you can't fault them for not competing against a team that wasn't there, but some will. Look, I know that bad breaks are part of the game. And of course, badly breaking the rules of international competition and the norms of sportsmanship shouldn't get any sympathy at all. And it would be a shame to reward a country which orchestrated such shame. But it would also be an injustice for the innocent to be punished for the misdeeds of a nation. Among the ideals of sport is that the outcomes are fair, but also that they serve as an alternative for politics and more literal forms of battle. As with so much surrounding the Olympics, the reality is far from ideal.
Mike Pesca hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, from Slate. He's a panelist on the sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, which posts every Monday. There's lots more to come on Only a Game, but while you're thinking about it, consider rating us on iTunes and leaving a review. It helps other listeners find our podcast, and we always like to hear your thoughts on our show. I'm Bill Littlefield.
It's disappointing that in my hometown won't be able to host the All-Star Game as they had planned. Obviously, I understand Adam Silver's decision.
That's Golden State Warriors star and Charlotte, North Carolina native Steph Curry talking to ESPN on Thursday. Curry was reacting to news coming out of the NBA commissioner's office that the All-Star Game in 2017 will not be in Charlotte, North Carolina. That's where it was supposed to be, and that's where we'll start this week's three stories you should know. Joining me are sports writer Eric Malinowski and David Steele of the Sporting News. Welcome back.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
David, tell us more about the decision coming out of the NBA commissioner's office.
This is something that they have been discussing ever since HB2, the House bill in North Carolina, with all the limitations and restrictions and laws of, about the treatment of LGBT and transgender people there first came out. The league was very excited about coming back to Charlotte. It's a market that they love, that they're very happy with. They got to a point this week where they just couldn't sustain the possibility of keeping it there. The owners, the teams, the other franchises, and the players so far have been 100% behind it. And I don't think that they would have been able to make a stand like this and make a decision like this and put this sort of pressure on the state if everybody wasn't on board with it.
The NBA did the right thing here, which is great. Give them all the credit in the world. They had to make this decision. But they're also a business. And the NBA also decided on some level that this was also really good business.
There is a lot of evidence that loss of income or potential loss of income can change how people view legislation. The vice presidential candidate of the Republican Party learned that when he pushed through a law that would have allowed business people to discriminate against members of the LGBT community in Indiana. He had to back off that law. And if the NBA's decision encourages people in North Carolina to say, hey, wait a minute, this is going to hurt us in the pocketbook, and to oppose discriminatory, fear-inspired, utterly illogical legislation, more power to him. I hope it happens. David, you want to wrap this up? I'm out of breath.
The NBA has a history of this. The NBA put on subtle pressure back in the 90s in the state of Arizona when they were fighting each other over the Martin Luther King holiday. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And even though the big lever was wielded by the NFL with the Super Bowl, the NBA played a very, very big part of this. And I think that the politicians in the State House and the governor's office really underestimated the NBA's resolve in using their leverage to get what they wanted.
Eric, I can't actually see you right now, but I am picturing you wearing a backwards Mariners baseball cap because you want to talk about Ken Griffey Jr., right?
Yes, along with my Mike Piazza jersey on. Yeah, I mean, the Baseball Hall of Fame is having its annual induction ceremony this weekend, and they're two really legitimate, iconic superstars going in. And we said one is Mike Piazza, who, you know, is the greatest hitting catcher of all time. He was drafted 62nd round, so never give up on your dreams, kids. But yeah, the other one is Ken Griffey Jr., who, you know, was really just the consummate five-tool player. He could do anything on the diamond excellently. You know, he followed Cal Ripken in the 94 baseball strike. Cal Ripken, who, you know, quote unquote, brought the game back, you know, with his Iron Man streak. And then we had the home run chase from 98 to 2001. And I feel like in that time frame, Griffey kind of got lost a little bit sort of in the baseball collective conscious. But I think to fans of a younger age, Griffey was immensely important. Like you said, it was the backwards hat. It was the Nike spots. It was that sweet left-handed uppercut swing. It was the Super Nintendo game. I hope that we use this weekend as an opportunity to remember exactly the impact it was that Griffey had, not only in the game back then, but I think on the game that remains today.
Baseball has had such a upheaval over the last few years, the last few decades. The record books and the scandals and just so much change. And not necessarily something for the better, and a lot of hard feelings. But who could ever really be upset about anything connected with Ken Griffey, except for the fact that he kind of got lost in the shuffle a little bit? I mean, he was as great an ambassador for baseball as anybody in our lifetime.
I like to remember, and I'll use the Hall of Fame weekend as an excuse to remember one particular image, and that was in 1990 when Ken Griffey Jr. and Ken Griffey, the original, were actually teammates. And they not only were teammates, they batted 3 and 4 in the Mariners' order. And in what other sport could you have father and son playing together at the highest level of the sport? You don't see a lot of NFL guys playing with their fathers.
What a romantic notion of baseball. You know, we talk about fathers and sons playing baseball. He actually got to play with his father. I mean, that's like raw, uncut baseball romanticism right there.
All right, I'm going to stick with baseball because I am concerned about the national pastime, or at least I'm going to pretend to be concerned about the national pastime. MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred said this week that he is in favor of, quote, something like restricting the number of relief pitchers a manager can use. I don't know what something like restricting the number means. I don't like the sound of it. The commissioner's concern, of course, is the length of baseball games. He and others are charged with marketing the game, which, by the way, is thriving. Profits are very high. Perhaps they also figure that fans would rather watch hitters knocking around very tired pitchers than fresh relief pitchers striking those hitters out. Whatever the logic behind the commissioner's support of something like, I don't like it. Unless we're talking about a safety issue, I think we should let the managers on the field do the managing. Let's not interfere by fiddling with the rules.
You know, baseball has this habit of looking at what can make the game more fun and make it more popular and doing the exact opposite. It's sort of a...
It's not easy to learn to do that either.
Exactly. Like, well, you know, Ty Cobb never faced, you know, 4 fresh relievers in the late innings of game. So why should these guys? It's baseball has survived. You know, really, honestly, all the attempts to by baseball itself to hurt it, and it really tells you something. It's the loyalty of the fan, the people who recognize it. There's a kernel of something that they truly love and truly relate to.
You know, baseball has had a rash this season of players getting popped for PEDs that were more common amongst East German swimmers in the 1980s. But yes, this is the scourge that is really going to take baseball down, is the overuse of bullpens. I just want, you know, if Rob Manfred is truly concerned that baseball drags on for far too long, then my advice to him would be to take a more macro level, shorten the season to 154 games, to back to what it used to be, and then you don't have the World Series butting up against Halloween.
I'm so glad that neither of you came out for the 7-inning game or 2 strikes and you're out.
Baby steps, baby steps.
My guests for this week's 3 Stories You Should Know have been sports writer Eric Malinowski and David Steele of the Sporting News. Thank you, both of you, very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back. December 28, 1958, was unseasonably warm in New York City, 47 degrees at 2 in the afternoon. Fans arriving at Yankee Stadium wore fashionable hats instead of the kind meant to keep your ears warm. They came to the house that Ruth built to watch the New York Giants challenge the Baltimore Colts for the NFL championship. This was still 8 years before the first Super Bowl. That warm afternoon in New York would turn Colts quarterback Johnny Unitas into a legend and establish pro football as a sport worth watching. It would come to be known as the greatest game ever played. But what if that day wasn't the most important day in the life of one of the most important men who played that game? What if it wasn't even close? Here's only a game's Karen Given.
Let's start with this. Gino Marchetti doesn't think you should believe everything that's been said about the 1958 NFL championship game.
I don't think it was the best game ever played. It was actually a little sloppy. But I've always said this. It was the most important game ever played.
Marchetti is 89 now. He's been in the Pro Football Hall of Fame for longer than I've been alive. He lives outside Philadelphia with his wife, Joan, and likes to tell old football stories to public radio reporters who call him up out of the blue.
I enjoy talking about football. I don't do that much anymore because most of my buddies are gone.
For a guy who'd end up in the Hall of Fame, Marchetti's football career didn't start very well.
I went to Antioch High School, and as a freshman, I went out for the football team. They cut me. They said I wasn't big enough, I wasn't strong enough. We need a uniform for somebody else. They only had 24 uniforms, but I still wanted to play, so I'd go to the equipment manager, who's a friend of mine, and we dug into the garbage, and we found enough uniforms to dress me up. You know, they were kind of old and raggedy, but anyway, I got permission from the coach to practice with them. So when I was a sophomore, I tried out again, and this time I made it. I played 3 years at Antioch High School, and I was not a very good football player.
In the spring of 1944, as his high school days were coming to an end, Marchetti made a decision. It was a decision that would change the entire course of his life. But if you ask him now, he can't even tell you why he did it.
I don't know why I joined the Army. It wasn't like I was going to fight for my country or something. But one day, I left the high school, picked up my girl, and we were riding down the street. And I just said, I'm going to join the Army. I was 17, I think. And she says, well, are you going to tell your folks? I says, no, I'll go join. I'll tell them when I get home. So I signed up, and 30 days later, I left for the U.S. Army.
Marchetti went to Europe with the 69th Infantry. He carried a machine gun through France, Belgium, and Germany. He fought in the Battle of the Bulge. But the story he likes to tell never made it into the history books.
My buddy and I, we were on a machine gun protecting the north flank of our regiment. We were having a good time. You hear these shells go over, and you can tell how far they're going by the sound of the wind behind them. You know, zoo. And we'd sit there and say, that one's way over there. A group wanted to relieve us, and we said, no, go back in the box. We're okay. About 10 minutes later, we heard this noise that was the worst noise I ever heard. It was an 88, and it was coming at us, and you could tell because of the whistling of the bomb. It was just terrible. Probably only took 10 seconds, and I thought everything that I had done badly with my mother, particularly one instance when she got mad at me and threw something at me, and hit her brand new refrigerator. And all she can do is touch that little nick. My new box. She was crying. And I thought of that. And I said, you know, when I get home, I'm going to make up for all the things I did or didn't do. You get a second chance, you got to make it work. It's the only life you got. You got to make it work. Going to the Army was the best thing I ever did. Because without that kind of discipline that they teach you, I wouldn't have been able to play football, I don't think.
After the war, Marchetti played football for the undefeated 1951 University of San Francisco Dons, and he was drafted in the second round by the New York Yanks. Yeah, that used to be the name of an NFL team. The Yanks moved to Dallas, where they became the Texans, and went bankrupt halfway through the season. Marchetti says the team became nomads, vagabonds.
Yeah, we had no home, no nothing. And that's when I scored my first touchdown as an NFL player. We had lost six straight or whatever. So a tight end got hurt, and the old veterans on the team, they were hiding. They didn't want to go in. So the coach looked at, who could play tight end? I raised my hand. I said, I could play tight end. And it was about a 35-yard pass, and I caught it and scored a touchdown. And then the gun went off to end the first half. And, Jesus, I really felt proud and good first touchdown till I heard the announcer say, Rams 46, Dallas 6. That was at halftime.
After that season, things started looking up for Marchetti and his team. They moved to Baltimore and became the Colts. Fast forward to 1958, and a 31-year-old Gino Marchetti is lining up for Baltimore on that balmy day in New York City for what would become known as the greatest game ever played.
I got involved in the biggest play. They were leading with a minute and 30 seconds to go, and they had a yard and a half to go for first down. So if they make the first down, the game's over.
Finally. To Gifford. Gifford off the tackle, smashes to about the 43-yard line, and it's going to be close as Gifford hugs that football.
Frank Gifford carried the ball, and I made the tackle. As I made the tackle, Big Daddy, he dived on, and somehow my leg got twisted, and he broke it. If I wasn't an old Army veteran, I'd have probably cried. But I didn't. No. My reaction was I wanted to see the end of the game.
Now, the Giants did not make the first down. They have the ball on their own 43-yard line. It's fourth down and about a yard to go. And we see the Don Chandler, the punter.
The Giants punted, and Johnny Unitas led the Colts down the field for a touchdown with just 7 seconds left in the fourth quarter. When the clock ran out, the score was 17-17. By this point, the game already had all the elements of a classic. A charismatic quarterback, an enthusiastic crowd in the stadium, and a national TV audience back home, not to mention the lasting controversy over whether Frank Gifford really did get that first down. But there was one more thing. See, back then, the NFL allowed regular season games to end in a tie, but no title game had ever ended that way.
A most historic moment in football history. The New York Giants won the toss. They elected to receive for their sudden death playoff with all the marbles on the line.
But Marchetti, who had been watching the game from a stretcher on the sidelines, wouldn't get to see it. Officials were worried that he'd get trampled by fans rushing the field, so they sent him down to the locker room.
The locker room was as quiet as you can be. You didn't know who was winning, who was losing. They had no radio, they had nothing. But then I think it was Bill Pellington busted into the locker room yelling, hey, we're champs! So then we started celebrating. We all had Coca-Colas. They wouldn't give us beer or nothing. Yeah, he had Coca-Colas. Frank Gifford, he always says, you know, Gino, I made that first down. I says, Frank, let me tell you something. Who's got the ring? I got the ring, so we won the game. That's all that counts. How lucky can a guy be? Everything I did was the right thing to do, and it all come because one day at Antioch High School, I decided I was going to join the Army.
Our story was produced by Karen Given in collaboration with Sports Illustrated, which profiled Gino Marchetti in their 2016 Where Are They Now issue, available now. You can go back and listen to all four of the stories we produced with SI at si.com/WATN. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports, NPR style. Next week on the show, rower Anders Weiss was cut from the Olympic eight-man rowing team, but one simple idea changed his approach to training, and now he's going to Rio. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. But what about a tomato if you called it a love apple and named a baseball team after it? But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
I don't generally care very much about All-Star games and their locations, except when a location is changed to make a political statement. What do you think of NBA Commissioner Adam Silver's decision to pull the 2017 All-Star game out of Charlotte to protest North Carolina's so-called bathroom bill?
Well, I think it's terrific. And if you'll notice, I think the NCAA has now asked prospective host cities to reply with a memo regarding their anti-discrimination ordinances. You know, once again, the legislature in North Carolina is not familiar with the concept of unintended consequences.
Answering the call that he himself helped to make at last week's ESPY Awards, Carmelo Anthony will host a meeting for L.A. community leaders, athletes, and politicians. The purpose of the meeting is to discuss recent shootings of and by police officers. Do you think Mr. Anthony can succeed where so many other efforts have apparently failed?
Well, I think the more efforts we have in this regard, the better. He is a unique and kind of ironic spokesman, but I don't see any harm in this.
Meanwhile, the WNBA is proud of the, quote, passionate advocacy for nonviolent solutions, end quote, expressed by their players, whom they have fined for their passionate advocacy. Wait, what?
Yeah, the Minnesota Lynx wore T-shirts expressing support for the most recent victims of police shootings. And as you said, the league is commending them for their social conscience and also commending them to take out their wallets.
This is kind of trying to have it both ways.
It's extraordinarily trying to have it both ways, yes. This is just stupid. I don't know what they're expecting to gain by the compliments.
Apparently, Charlie, people in Cleveland, Ohio are still going nuts about the Cavaliers winning the NBA championship. I guess this is maybe because nothing else of note is happening in Cleveland this week.
Oh, lots of things of note are happening in Cleveland, Bill. In fact, they're all in my notebook. There have been various unsuccessful attempts to glom onto the Cavaliers and LeBron James during the Republican National Convention, mostly from the podium and mostly extraordinarily awkward.
I can't imagine why. But anyway, we might not really know whether any athlete representing Russia will be allowed to compete in Rio until the games actually begin. Now the IOC has announced that 45 doping samples from previous Olympics have tested positive using, quote, the very latest scientific analysis methods. So those athletes will be banned as well. How many people are going to be left to compete when the Olympics open?
I have no idea, but this kind of retroactive purge is really embarrassing. I know that it's the biggest problem in the history of sports and perhaps even the biggest problem in the history of man. But, you know, give me a break. This isn't, you know, the use of advanced DNA technology to put, you know, a rapist in jail who'd gotten away with his crime. I mean, let's not pretend this has anything to do with law enforcement.
It has now been more than a week since Tom Brady declared that he will not appeal his Deflategate suspension to the Supreme Court. The scandal lasted, I can't say this without 100 years, 545 days. Does that make it the silliest sports issue of our time? I know, it's a high bar.
No, it is a high bar, but it's very, very close to being the silliest one, if only for the longevity of it, if only for the piddling offense, if offense there was, at the root of the whole thing.
You know, I have to acknowledge, I was kind of hoping it would make it to the Supreme Court and they would take it. And then all the justices, whether there were eight or nine, however many were actually seated at the time that it came up, would just sit there and giggle.
They're not a bunch of gigglers in my experience. There was absolutely no chance that they would have granted cert on this.
Two former pro wrestlers have accused the WWE of, quote, selling violence. If you're the WWE, what do you say besides, well, yeah?
And your point would be?
Yes.
I mean, did these guys read their contracts?
Probably not.
Yes, it's professional wrestling.
On the serious side, Charlie, over 50 former pro wrestlers are suing the WWE over head injuries. Some of the wording sounds very similar to what's been in the suits against the NFL and the NHL. Does the fact that pro wrestling is show business rather than a sport matter in a lawsuit like this?
I don't know why it should. People sue studios all the time. Negligence when they get injured on film sets. I remember Vic Morrow's family winning a lot of money from one of the studios when he was killed on the set of the Twilight Zone movie. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be easier to win, frankly, rather than harder, if the court is willing to decide that the WWE is a show and not a sport.
Nate Ebner has been named to the U.S. Olympic rugby team. His day job, of course, is with the New England Patriots, and his coach, Bill Belichick, has said that he figures Mr. Ebner will be getting excellent physical conditioning, working out for the rugby match, and it's fine with him that Ebner will be missing the Patriots training camp, or at least some portion of it. Help me to understand who has kidnapped Coach Belichick and replaced him with this amiable fellow.
No, the important thing to remember is that Nate Ebner is primarily a special teams player, and therefore all he really has to do is keep his crazy in shape. And one can do that playing rugby just as well as at training camp.
You're telling me that if this was a frontline player of some significance, Coach Belichick might not feel quite the same way about his going off to play rugby?
I was about to say, if Tom Brady suddenly discovered a gift for, archery, I don't think he'd be going to Rio.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie. Why not? He's going to miss four games anyway. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated. And he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
Anybody can walk through Hyde Park. You don't need a ticket to do it. Even when the Olympics are going on in London, which they were in the summer of 2012, the last time I was in Hyde Park, you can walk around as if the Olympics weren't there. Set in the vastness of Hyde Park, there is a body of water called the Serpentine. It's 40 acres of recreational lake. 40 acres. I looked it up. I didn't know it was that big when my wife and I came upon it on a hot, windless August afternoon. We had seen gymnastics, we would see basketball, but we didn't have tickets to see anything that day, so we were in Hyde Park, and so were a lot of other people. They were lining the banks of the Serpentine, except for the ones who were walking across a bridge, which might have been the bridge that marks the boundary between Hyde Park and Kensington Gardens. Or maybe not. It wasn't the only bridge. But it was the one my wife and I stopped on because we noticed that there were people swimming in the Serpentine. There were also people in boats. Apparently their job was to keep the geese away from the swimmers. It looked like a competition, which is because it was. It was the women's marathon swim. And the course was marked by bright inflatable buoys around which women from Spain, Italy, Germany, France, and Great Britain were churning. Women from Mexico, the Czech Republic, and the U.S. were doing that too. We watched them until a police officer told us we couldn't stop on the bridge. You mean we have to have tickets? My wife asked. No, said the officer. You just can't stop on the bridge. We went back the way we'd come, turned left at the end of the bridge, and found a spot on the bank of the lake where we could continue to watch the women swim. On the far shore, across the expanse of the Serpentine, at what may have been the finish line, there was a grandstand. It was full of people who probably had tickets. When I was a kid, people selling baseball programs used to shout, "You can't tell the players without a scorecard." And that was before the players' names were on the backs of their jerseys. That day, we couldn't have told the players even if we'd had a scorecard. They were mostly underwater. But that wasn't the point. No tickets, my wife said. Right, I said. At one point, we left the bank of the lake and walked to a booth where a man was selling ice cream. And when we returned to the bank, the women were still swimming long laps around the buoys. We hadn't missed a thing. As anyone who has ever gone to the Olympics knows, we had paid a lot of money for the tickets to the gymnastics and the basketball competitions. You would recognize the names of a lot of the winners of those competitions if I mentioned them here. Maybe that's why the tickets were so expensive. You probably don't recognize the name of Eva Reztov, the Hungarian woman who won the marathon swim and the serpentine that afternoon. Haley Anderson, an American, got the silver medal. She was 4/100ths of a second behind Miss Reztov, which may have broken Miss Anderson's heart since she and Eva Reztov had both been swimming for nearly 2 hours when that happened. The fourth place finisher missed a medal by a fraction of a second. On the evening of that day in Hyde Park, I had no idea who had won. I didn't know until I looked it up much later. And before that afternoon, I hadn't even known the Olympics included a marathon swim in a lake. All I knew was that my wife and I had watched the Olympics for free in the park. I felt as if I'd put something over on the corporate sponsors. When people ask about our trip to London, my wife and I talk about the gymnasts we saw and the two basketball games, one of which included LeBron James, and that was all great. But the story we most enjoy telling is the one about the event we saw for free, without intending to do it, by walking into Hyde Park. A rose is a rose is an onion. Ernest Hemingway wrote that, perhaps to thumb his nose at Gertrude Stein, and maybe he was saying that names are important, because they are. Christopher Jones is a minor league baseball executive.
You can just say Chris.
And an informal kind of guy. He used to be the general manager of a team from California called the Storm, and then he became the GM of a Texas team called the Skeeters. And this past March, Chris became president of a Cleveland Indians affiliate in Lynchburg, Virginia, called the Hillcats, and therein lies the problem and the challenge.
You know, merchandise sales was one of the lowest in minor league baseball.
Chris thought he knew why the sale of Hillcats stuff was slack.
My kids played Little League baseball, and when I was with the Lake Elsinore Storm, yeah, my kids wanted to be the Storm. When I was with the Sugarland Skeeters, my kids' teams wanted to be the Skeeters because they thought it was cool. So mentioned to them if they wanted to be the Hillcats team, and they kind of rolled their eyes. Maybe that's the issue, that the Hillcats isn't cool enough. We said, maybe a name change would be good.
So, on behalf of the Hillcats and the merchandise they weren't moving, Chris invited fans to come up with a name that would induce them to buy caps and jerseys, because though minor league baseball is about baseball, it's also about selling stuff. The fans obliged.
The Lamb Chops, the River Runners, the Dove.
All right, a bit strange, but any stranger than Mud Hens, Iron Pigs, Wing Nuts, because those are all the names of minor league teams.
And the Love Apples.
What?
I guess the translation of the French word for tomato is love apple.
I'm sorry, what?
For a logo, I would assume some kind of angry tomato.
I'm still confused. So I make another call, this one to an expert on a legend concerning one of the founding fathers and tomatoes.
The legend goes that he was standing on the steps trying to entice people to grow this unusual vegetable, I guess, in Lynchburg. So he ate it and didn't keel over and die or have any other bad effects.
We're going to get back to that keeling over and dying bit in a second, but first let's introduce Peggy Cornett.
Curator of plants at Monticello.
Which should clue you in to the identity of that guy with the unusual vegetable. Monticello was, of course, the home of Thomas Jefferson, president of the United States from 1801 until 1809, when he actually did die, tragically, after eating a tomato. Nah, then there would have been no story. Anyway, Monticello wasn't the only place in Virginia where Thomas Jefferson had a home.
He had a retreat home near Lynchburg called Poplar Forest.
Lynchburg, remember? The home of the Hillcats. And it was there, legend has it, that Thomas Jefferson ate a tomato in front of a crowd and didn't die. So why was eating a tomato an allegedly brave act of ingestion?
Well, there's lots of European botanists that came along and said it was poisonous.
Andrew F. Smith is a culinary historian and professor at the New School in New York.
They defined it as poisonous because it was associated with mandrake.
Wood curses kill as doth the mandrake's groan, or so says Shakespeare anyway. According to the Lynchburg legend, Thomas Jefferson wanted to prove the tomato wasn't poisonous, and that's why he took that bite one day in Lynchburg and, by virtue of not dying, introduced the tomato to America. But is that legend, the one upon which Chris Jones and his baseball team may be pinning the legitimacy of the team's new name, really true?
It is hooey.
Professor Smith spent 8 years researching the history of the fruit for his 1984 book, The Tomato in America.
No one really thought the tomato was poisonous in America. And the first American recipe is really 1772. So the presumption is that if you have a recipe and somebody puts it in a book, most likely they've been eating it well before that.
But Jefferson's relationship with the tomato was still an important one. It's hard for me to believe I've said that, but bear with me for the sake of the story. Professor Smith says that when he was in Europe, Jefferson would send different varieties of tomato seeds back home. Again, Monticello's Peggy Cornett.
Jefferson was trying to get people to try different vegetables and products that would make us self-sufficient. So he was always trying to introduce new plants to America. He said the greatest service could be rendered any country is to add a useful plant to its culture.
So even though the legend might not be true, heck, it isn't true, Jefferson didn't even call the fruit a love apple. He called it a tomato.
You like tomato.
And you like tomato.
Potato.
Potato.
Tomato.
Tomato.
Let's call a tomato.
Yeah, you knew that was coming, didn't you? Peggy Cornett likes the idea of naming the baseball team in Lynchburg the Love Apples anyway.
Yeah, I think it's kind of sweet. You know, Love Apple, it's a nice tribute to Thomas Jefferson. You know, another name for the tomato, though, was Wolf's Peach. So they might want to consider being the Wolf's Peaches.
The Lynchburg Wolf's Peaches. I like it. But what about the players? They're the ones who might have to wear a uniform featuring an angry tomato. What do they think about becoming the Love Apples?
Every time I'm down there, they ask me, how's it going? Or, you know, what are the names? And I think for them, it doesn't really matter.
That's team president Chris Jones again.
The guys that are coming to us are leaving us and going to the rubber duckies, you know, the Akron rubber duckies. So I think that, you know, they get to this level, they're just happy to be at this level and wanting to get to the next level, which is the rubber ducks.
And you thought this story couldn't get any sillier, which brings us to the question of whether a team called the Rubber Duckies is sillier than one called the Love Apples. A minor league conundrum, if ever there was one. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder, and our intern is Ian Foster. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from food scholar Andrew Smith on whether he thinks public radio really can produce a fun, insightful, and informative show about sports.
Well, it is hooey, but whether you want to tell them or not is another issue here.
Is hooey good? Hooey's good, right? I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thanks for listening.